Welcome to the Cambridge Tech Podcast, talking all things technology from the heart of the UK's tech capital. Here are your hosts, Faye Holland and James Parton.
Hi, I'm Faye.
And I'm James. So, what have you been up to this week, Faye?
A few things of note. So Peter Carroll's pre-order has opened for his new book. If you remember, we spoke to him earlier on this year, and his book, Public Success, Private Grief, is now open. For information, go to publicsuccess-privategrief.com, where you can find out more information, a little teaser to the book, and how to pre-order. So we've got him booked in for the book launch on the 17th of April already. So that's one piece of news. 21 to Watch has gone out for the announcement event on the 7th of March. The deadline is fast approaching in January. So 12th of January you've got if you want to submit to that competition, and we'll announce the shortlist in February. And we've also been finalising some PR for Cambridge Science Centre, who have got a really good announcement at the start of next year. So another good thing to watch out for. What about you?
Yeah, a mix of family stuff and work stuff. Monday and Tuesday, I was down in Brighton for my son's graduation. So both of them have graduated pretty close to each other in the last like month. So that was good fun. And then I guess on the work side, I guess the highlight was long listing for the Trinity Bradfield Prize. So just whittling all of the applications down for our judging panel to take a look at next week.
That's great. Exciting times. So let's move on to the news. We have four pieces of news for you today. So let's get through those. First up, Arm CEO René Haas has appealed to the UK government to make it easier for the Cambridge Superchip architect to recruit tech talent. Haas told Bloomberg that hiring world-class talent in the form of top engineers remained their biggest challenge to sustain future growth of the business. If that becomes even harder next year because of the change in government following a general election, it will create a real headwind he wouldn't want to face.
IQ Geo, the Cambridge-based geospatial software specialist, has won a contract worth around $3 million for 5 years from a Tier 1 US utility provider. IQ Geo software will mobilise field workforces across the customer's electric and gas operations. The utility provides transmission and distribution services to more than 5 million customers across 8 states and will be using IQ Geo software licences to support field crews managing its electric and gas network.
Cambridge trailblazer Riverlane has formed a triple UK-Canada alliance to fast-track quantum computers to scale. It's working with Canadian company Nuvu Cameras and Oxford-based Inflection in the project, and the idea is designed to help quantum computers see their qubits. The trio will be developing imaging systems to measure qubit states, a vital capability for quantum computers to scale, according to Riverlane.
And finally, radar technology company Cambridge Sensorius has won a National Aerospace Technology Exploitation Programme grant. This is to deliver an ultra-lightweight onboard detection and avoidance radar tracking avionics system. The system leverages micro-radar technologies that have been specifically developed for low-altitude flight onboard uncrewed aerial systems and will be adapted and introduced to the crewed aircraft. And that's the news this week. Now on to our episode.
So we're here today at Form the Future's annual conference over at the Moller Centre. And James, we're here all day listening in and talking to people, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So Anne Bailey, who's the CEO of Form the Future, kicked things off really well this morning. And it was really good to hear that explanation of the role of the organisation being that bridge between employers and young people.
And you spoke to Daniel Zeichner as well, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So Daniel's the local MP, and I got an opportunity to grab him as he walked off stage to get some one-on-one questions with him. Daniel, thanks so much for your time. My first question is, in your talk, you talked about human potential and the fact that you spend most Fridays going into local schools. And you mentioned an issue around the career aspirations of young people that you talk to. We heard a lot about the need for UK education to teach more around science, maths, computer science, as a way of starting to build a pipeline for technology.
But is that enough? How do you teach things like entrepreneurship? How do you teach things like taking more risk with your career, so people are thinking more widely than just traditional careers that you mentioned in your talk?
Well, I mean, I think it's two things for me. One is the whole notion of careers and the careers advice that we see in schools. And frankly, I don't think the UK has done particularly well on this over the last 20, 30 years. Too often, I'm afraid, the people who are giving the advice don't have that experience from the outside world. So I think a lot of this is actually about getting people into schools who can bring something to inspire. It's not a criticism of the teachers.
Yeah.
They are teachers. They're not necessarily entrepreneurs as well. It's also, I think, about a culture change in the country, because we, I think, are still quite a risk-averse country. And saying to people, it doesn't matter too much if you don't succeed first time.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge evangelical fan of the American approach to life, but I do think we're too far away from that much more go-getting and ambitious culture that you do see in the tech world in California. I think it's a change of culture. But I would also say that look at some of the local inspiration. I mean, in Cambridge here, we've got some of the best video games companies in the world who've created some of the biggest, most successful games. And whether you're a techie person or whether you're an arts person, that's where the two things come together. So I think getting some of those people in front of students would really inspire as well.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue to the second question, which is around role models and culture. You had a really interesting exchange with the Prime Minister this week around his interaction with Elon Musk. What are your thoughts on that kind of US almost celebrity-led culture, billionaire founders, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Elon Musks of the world? On one side of things, that does create very strong role models, which young people might aspire to emulate. But that also comes with a whole bunch of other issues. Mm. What do you think is appropriate for the UK and the UK tech sector?
I think the UK is completely different from America. I mean, having said we need to get a bit more of that American risk approach, I think the great strength of the UK and Europe is a much more collaborative approach. Mm. So I don't think we want to see those kind of role models, quite frankly. I think what we want to look at is fantastic examples on our own doorstep. How many people in Cambridge, for instance, know about ARM? You know, that every single device we're looking at here is being developed on the back of people in Cambridge. Well, explaining that to people, I think, can inspire, but it's something that David Cleverly, who's obviously a big Cambridge tech entrepreneur, has always been saying to me. He said, people even in Cambridge don't understand and appreciate just what Cambridge is. Mm. So sell ourselves better. Yeah. Understand ourselves better, and I think we can show that we are world leaders. We really are. We just don't shout about it very much. Perhaps it's that British reserve.
Yeah, absolutely. But final question. Cambridge is not just a UK significant tech cluster. It's obviously a globally significant tech cluster. That brings both pros and cons, which we talk fairly regularly about on the podcast. How do you see the balance of the needs of the sector to grow locally, and how do they do that in harmony with the needs of the city?
Well, it is the biggest challenge, and I spend a lot of my time talking about this. The thing that's attractive about Cambridge is its size and intimacy, and in fact, it's not a massive conglomeration. So that's the challenge. I genuinely think it does have to grow, because if you don't grow, you probably go backwards. So trying to get a high quality of life from a bigger community, and that will be about getting affordable housing for people, but the biggest challenge is getting a transport system that allows people to get about, and that's probably a subject for another day. But people are thinking really hard about this, and it will be the test of whether we can do it or not, because if Cambridge just becomes another big place, then that will lose the essence of why Cambridge is so magical and special.
Thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And then we also joined many of the different sessions throughout the day as well. One of the first ones I joined had Ryan Kelsall. He's from the Eastern Learning Alliance. And he put the whole day in context when he said that we don't learn work skills at school, we learn through experience. And that for me is really important, and why organisations like Form the Future exist, to fill that gap.
Yeah, I was in the session that was discussing the needs of Gen Z. Some really interesting conversation there. Lots of good common sense. You know, a comment was made, you can't broad brush an entire generation by a set of characteristics that might not apply. And, you know, that's kind of obvious. So I guess I'm Gen X. And
I'm a Gen X, so I'm guessing
we don't have the same kind of likes and dislikes and behaviours. So,
do you not think so?
I'm willing to bet.
But, yeah, okay.
So why would you treat an entire generation in the same way? But, you know, there's a lot of talk about flexible work and the impact of COVID. I thought another thing that crops up a lot, I think, today is this whole feedback from industry saying that Gen Z are lacking certain skills that make them employable. And, you know, a lot of talk about soft skills, but the kind of frustration that I detected in the conversation was that's all well and good saying that, but unless you're specific, you can't address it, you know? So there needs to be better explanation about what exactly is missing, so either schools or employers or both can address that.
It's not going to be any different for Gen Z as it was for millennials, as it was for our generation, and on it goes.
You know, who walked into the first day of their job and knew what to do?
Oh, I did.
That's because you started your own company.
Yeah, okay. What else? Volunteering was very high on the agenda as well. As you know, anyone who volunteers knows it gives a huge benefit to you as an individual, but actually as the organisation, it's a really good thing to do. We talked about it on the Wealth Gap podcast. I volunteered previously for Form the Future, and actually on the back of that Wealth Gap episode that we did, I reinstated that commitment to actually go back and volunteer. The only problem is, and I can't remember if I've told you this before, when I did What's My Line, so they basically, the pupils have to guess from what you say to them, they have to guess what your job is, and they all said I was a politician. Have I told you that before?
That's PR and comms is.
Yeah, it's because I'm like highly diplomatic, and everyone who knows me can choose how they wish to interpret that. But actually, so in this whole session about volunteering, there was a lady called Nikki Hughes, who's from Cambridge University Museums, and she said she'd had a particularly trying time when one of the kids had asked her, "If you didn't do your job, would the world notice?" I'm like,
what a killer question.
Oh my goodness. And she's like, flipping heck, I had an existential crisis right there and then. But actually, what a good question. And that's the fun as well of doing some of these volunteering things. It actually really makes you think.
Maybe we should have that question on every episode moving forward when we interview a guest.
Should we? We might start restricting brutal. Some of our guests.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, it's been a really interesting day, and we have managed to grab various people to talk about DEI, Gen Z we're going to talk about. So let's get on and interview a few people. So first of all, we're going to talk to Tyler Shores, who's the ThinkLag manager at the University of Cambridge. So Tyler, welcome. You spoke early on in the day about some research you've done about the first day at work. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that research and what some of the highlights were?
Happy to talk about it, yes. So the ThinkLab works across different organizations, across different sectors. And one of the things that has been a recurring theme has been accessibility, specifically neurodiversity in the workplace. And basically, how do we lower some of those barriers of entry? From personal experience, I can say when it's starting a new job, I've had everything from a two-week orientation process working at Google, where it felt like being in school again, and it's a lot of information all at once. Starting a new job at the start of the very first COVID lockdown, no orientation whatsoever. Here's a laptop, here's an email address, go figure everything out. So what we're interested in is just sort of all of those other things that don't necessarily happen. So the informal learning that happens in a workplace, essentially the way I would summarize it is just those questions that you're too afraid to ask in terms of like, I don't want to sound dumb, but how does this work or how does that work? So one of the things that we test piloted for one of our UK organizations was a buddy system. So not quite a boss, not quite a, you know, a network thing, but someone you can ask those questions to in terms of like, oh, how does this work? Or what does that acronym mean? Or all of that. And just like ways to ease that in so that people can kind of dip their toes rather than being thrown into the deep end. And it's a lot of that. So like we've continued continued that with some of our Think Lab work with BBC in terms of looking at especially folks who started during the pandemic and who've only known remote work, who've only known what it's like to work remotely or not in a physical space. So how does all of that informal learning, the unwritten rules of the workplace happen? So we've tried to see, like, how do we do that better to make it more welcoming for people?
Was the research conducted with different kinds of industry verticals and sectors? So got a good kind of broad representation.
Yes.
I mean, going into that then, did you have a feel for how many companies in the UK have a more formalized onboarding process that has the structure that people might need versus the situation you described as just being left to figure things out?
Yeah. It was a little bit of a range, I would say. The larger companies tended to have a little bit more of a process in terms of, like, this is how we onboard, this is how we've done it. Encouragingly enough, I think COVID was a bit of a catalyst in terms of maybe we should rethink some of these things, like how we're actually going about this process, because the old rules went out the window right around March 2020. So it was a range, and there was a little bit when it comes to, like, the smaller and medium companies feeling a little bit more like, oh, you know, what are we going to do with all of this? Maybe we're kind of starting from scratch, or maybe we just need to seriously rethink the way we're doing it. So we found that interesting, how to get people to really start thinking on their feet, how to start rethinking things. So in some cases, it's given organizations permission to experiment, to find more information about what actually works and what's making people connect and tick.
Intuitively, you would think it would be hopefully obvious that the more you invest in the new starter, the quicker they become productive. But have you now got that kind of data that shows if you invest up front, you get much better return?
Yes. So we've worked with Aviva, and this is fairly public now, I think, to help them with their neurodiversity employment scheme, where it was essentially that started out, helped them design a pilot program, which they've now built into their employment and recruitment process, which is great. I'll give you the opposite of data, which is just my personal experience too, is that weirdly, I actually liked the here's your email, here's your computer, just go figure things out. I learned a lot that way by just talking to people and just, I have no idea what I'm doing right up front in terms of, like, so start me from the beginning. That actually ended up opening a lot of conversations, which were surprising. And I wouldn't be doing things the way I do them now if it weren't for that kind of get thrown into the deep end. So maybe there's a little bit of a hybrid approach in terms of, like, making sure you're investing in that immersion, employability, startup thing, but also, like, giving people free rein too to just go explore, no map, just go figure things out on your own.
So our next guest is Charlotte Stegall, who was employee number 5 at Form the Future and has since moved on to Aviva and now WTW. I've known you for a long time, and I know you're very passionate about supporting the next generation. And now your job is really about providing that bridge between young people and hiring managers. So please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So yes, I'm Charlotte Stegall. I'm at WTW. I'm a global employer brand manager. And I've been in this role for about 4 or 5 months. The reason why I took up an employer, it was a bit of a right turn. I have always done marketing bits as part of my roles over the past, like, decade or so, I'd say. But I really wanted to explore more how we use language to actually tell young people what they can and can't achieve in life, and how can we make that better to allow for more young people to explore all the magical things you can do in a career.
Great. And one of the things you were talking about today, you're on the Gen Z panel, and I know you talk about this very often. And that's really what we want to talk to you about on the podcast. And James and myself, we actually had a bit of a discussion about it as we came out of the panel session, saying, I don't identify with my group. I'm a Gen X. I don't identify with that at all. So why do we expect Gen Z to identify that for themselves, or is it really just some kind of HR labeling? Have we gone a little bit mad with the labeling, I think, is kind of our first question.
I think there's definitely a sweet spot there. As a millennial, I do identify quite hard as a millennial, but that's because I graduated university in 2009. And I think who I am as an employee definitely has been shaped by what that market looked like. I worked abroad for a long time, and that in a way has shaped me as a person as well. So I think on one hand, Gen Z are definitely shaped by the environment right now. They're using ChatGPT a lot and all of these different elements of growing up right now. But on the flip side, yeah, I do think we use it a little bit too much. I had a team of 10 Gen Z in my last role. I took one of them to a conference, and at the conference, they were saying, oh, Gen Z, they don't smoke and they don't drink and they don't party. And my colleague was saying, yeah, I don't recognize this. This isn't my experience. So I think we label them too much, and we might even be telling them what they should be and creating a bigger culture than what it actually is. Maybe everyone just needs to calm down a little bit about it.
You mentioned there in your answer that you identify as a millennial strongly. Why? You know, then that's a genuine question. You know, what do you feel that gives you in terms of an identity?
I think the general vibes of a millennial are being a little bit anxious. Like on TikTok, you quite often have these, like, how the different generations are in the workplace. And millennials are rereading emails and just double checking and making sure that everything's okay, and like really hesitantly clicking send and be like, oh gosh. And that is me. And I think how I've been shaped like that has been the job market. Like I said, there were no jobs when I graduated, and certainly graduate programs and so on weren't for the likes of me. So I went abroad and learned everything that way and came back and struggled a little bit to find my place and to find what I am actually good at. And I think it's that general anxiety, it's that nervousness to be secure that a lot of people my age have. That's not to say that people of other generations don't have those same things, right? But especially, I think, the environment that we came to grow up in and we came to the workplace in has definitely shaped us to a certain extent as a generation.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Do you think that it's then the responsibilities of the employer? Because if you're in a workplace and you're kind of, oh, do I send that email? Just pause for a minute before I press send. You know, some of that actually is being conscious about your work, and that's not a bad thing. But there was another thing said in the panel, which is, Gen Zs, they don't send emails and they don't answer phones. Well, that's kind of crazy. It's crazy, right? Isn't it our job just to teach them if they can't do that?
WTW is an insurance company, and the insurance world actually does a lot of really great things for diversity. And in the autumn, there was a brilliant international festival called Dive In. So I'm bilingual with Japanese, and I was able to listen into a Japanese talk, and it was fascinating. They're talking about the next generation coming in. And in Japan, in work, there are so many rules in the workplace that you don't get taught. You have to just sit and experience them. As a sponge, you need to soak it all up and learn from your elders. And what the speaker was saying is that Gen Z have not had this opportunity because we've all been in lockdowns. You've all been in your rooms. You haven't been able to, by osmosis, take in all of these things. And I thought that's actually a viewpoint that I haven't heard being spoken about in the West, but it's absolutely true. The virtual work experiences that people did during lockdowns were great. And as someone who I did one at Aviva, it was an experience and we did our best, but they didn't fit the gap. Young people need to experience. And as much as I love working from home, we need to be in the office more, and we need to give these young people the opportunity to overhear us in our conversations and to pick up those skills so that they can actually learn how to answer a phone and to write an email.
So I thought the panel tackled that really well in the conversation. And there was that really well-made point around this assumption that everyone could just work remotely through the pandemic and be successful was really, you know, based on an assumption that they had the skills and the knowledge of how the company works and the relationships in place with their colleagues to be successful. And clearly that's not the case for new entrants into the workplace. So moving forward, you know, do you feel like it's going to be important for young career people to spend more time in the office rather than just assume that they want flexible working?
I think there's two points to this. Absolutely, they need to be in the office and to experience, to overhear and to learn from their colleagues and their leaders. But also, this is Cambridge Tech Podcast, right? We're in Cambridge. Rents are really, really high. If you think an apprentice, for example, will probably be around, if it's a good company, maybe 22K, 25K, that's not enough to have a place of your own. So you're probably going to be in a house share. Even on a graduate salary, I think the average graduate salary is around 30, 32, something around that. You're still going to be living in a house share, especially in Cambridge, on that salary. So just think about the actual experience of that young person working from home. You're in a really tight bedroom, sharing a space with maybe four or five other people. That's not a good place to be working with. And especially during the lockdowns, I definitely supported a lot of young people in Cambridge who were working for us, who would come off the end of their working day, close their laptop, open up Xbox and start playing and then do that into the evening. And they're in their childhood bedroom because they couldn't afford to move from home. That is not a good experience. But on the flip side, when they do come into the office, you need people like us in the office too. But we're really selfish. We want to be at home with our cats and with our fridge and to do the washing and stuff like that. So leaders and managers need to give up some of that flexibility in order to bring up the next generation and make it so that they can actually thrive in our cultures.
Charlotte, it's been great insights from you. I've got a final question. A lot of our listeners work in the tech businesses within Cambridge. So you're an influencer on this subject. What's your one rallying call that you can say to businesses that they need to do to engage with this audience?
The panel that I just came from was in the apprenticeship space, and I can't remember how we got on it, but I was talking about when redundancies happen, it is us that goes first. It's early careers people, because things like apprenticeship programs, graduate programs, work experience programs, they're nice to haves. That if you're going to spend 50K on something, you'd rather spend it on one experienced professional than two apprentices or two grads, right? And I think Cambridge companies need to invest better and don't see what we do as a nice to have, because it's really vital, not just as a nice thing to do for the next generation, but also to build that pipeline for your company, to build those skills that you need and to really shape that generation so that your businesses can actually take advantage of everything that Gen Z has to offer. And it's a heck of a lot.
Joining us now is Miguela Gonzalez, who is Head of Diversity Inclusion at Abcam. Welcome.
Hello, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. It's a busy day. Why don't we start with Abcam and your role there? What's your vision for inclusion and diversity at Abcam?
That's an interesting one, because it's a huge vision, isn't it? You're thinking about considerations for the workforce alongside considerations for our customers who we serve. So the idea is that, you know, and you've heard this before, we want to embed inclusion in everything that we do. We want to make sure that Abcam is a place that's accessible to everyone. We want to make sure that Abcam is a place where we can really harness potential and that we don't use like biases or any sort of other structural barriers to stop people from maximizing on their potential at Abcam. But we also want to empower our staff to have the knowledge and be properly rooted in understanding around equality and diversity so that we can serve our customers properly, so that they can maximize on their potential, because our whole mission is about serving our customer, about making sure that they can do their research faster. And the only way we can do that is to be fully inclusive in terms of how we approach them and understanding what their needs are.
And I think anyone who follows you on social media will really get that feeling. You know, every time you look at an Abcam post, you're showcasing an individual or something that you do. And it really does, it comes across really positively. So if anyone hasn't looked, I kind of urge you to go and take a look. But it must be challenging as well, because it's a big set of objectives that you've got, you know, and DEI is never going to go away. It's kind of an ongoing program. What are the challenges that you find in that?
You rightly said DEI is huge, and obviously it's rooted in people and behaviors and laws and norms and things that change constantly. I think the main thing is about staying curious and keeping on top of how things are changing, being respectful to people's expectations and knowing what the law is. Those are the main things you have to think about. But then once you do that, you have to think about all of those foundational things within processes, what sort of data you need, what the systems are like, to make sure you can strip away from systemic issues that might impede on your work.
Are you giving us a sense of just how large the scope of the role is? I'm kind of curious in terms of like the internal governance of Abcam. You know, do you and your team go out and kind of educate internally and show best practice? Do you have the ability to recommend change and to implement change in different departments? Is it a collaboration? How does it work on a functional day-to-day basis?
It's a good question. So on a functional day-to-day basis, I'm part of the people experience team. So we're like a group of SMEs that work together in different aspects of culture within the company. And so obviously my remit is inclusion in particular. And I always sort of joke and say I'm a bureaucrat. So I'm a bureaucrat. I'm setting up governance structures and, you know, processes and terms of reference to make sure that we have clarity around where accountability lies. Because I think often, and I'm being really general now, often when we talk about diversity and inclusion within institutions or within companies, the accountability piece is where there's no clarity at all. Who's accountable for what, and what are we actually trying to deliver here? How are we monitoring it? And is that monitoring feasible? Are these objectives smart, and do they really create an impact? And so that's what we're trying to do right now. So I've been 2 years in the role. It's a fairly new space for ABCAM. So I've entered ABCAM, which has a really open culture. So you're starting, you know, with a good culture, a good basis to start with. So it's just a matter of straightening that out and making sure that all functions are on the same page with regards to this work. We just recently put out a compulsory DEI playlist. So it's a set of courses. If you look at the set of courses, for people who are well-versed in DEI, they might think, oh, that's rather basic. But what we're trying to do is make sure that everyone across the company globally has the same understanding of the expectations and of behaviors and culture across the business, and then build it from there. But at the same time, I'm working directly with our teams who deal with customers to build that into the work that they're doing. And we're looking to build on our work within supply chain as well. So it's across the whole company. It's quite wide-ranging.
Yeah, and that level set and consistency is so important, isn't it? Especially for a company the size of ABCAM. And again, you're global. So, you know, getting everyone on the same page, whatever location they're in, is really important. So just going back to, you're one of the largest employers in Cambridge, in the region. We're at the Form the Future conference. You know, we're talking about developing future talent. What do you do specifically to help develop future talent?
So over time, we've developed quite a robust outreach program, and a lot of our departments are quite committed to it. It's even built into ESG goals for our senior leadership teams. You know, they're expected to mentor, they're expected to volunteer, they're expected to create early careers opportunities within their departments. So it's literally embedded into the work that they do. But also, we have quite a substantial cohort of people who volunteer within our employee resource groups, and they actively go out and try to do that outreach work as well and spread that message. We've worked with Form the Future for several years. We had a work experience week over the summer that was phenomenal. It was 30 odd students who came to us across functions. So we sent that message that you don't even have to just be a scientist in order to work within biotech. And it was really a great learning experience for us as well as for them. So it's a sort of mosaic of activities that are happening right now. And, you know, you're learning as you go along. And soon we're going to figure out where that real impact lies. Obviously, we had a bit of a blip with COVID. But what our end game is to look at what our socioeconomic diversity stats are like and the other characteristics as well, and to see if we can see a slow uptick in what we're doing with the work that we're doing right now. So we can measure that, again, going back to accountability, so we can measure the impact that we're doing with Form the Future. But it's been a brilliant relationship so far, and I'm really optimistic about what's coming up.
We've also managed to grab hold of Prashant Shah, who's the chair of Form the Future. And Prashant, it's great to see you here floating about. Tell us what you've thought about the conference.
First word, wow. What tremendous energy, what tremendous excitement, the diversity of people here, the quality of the discussion. It's tremendous work by the team, but it also kind of showcases the impact that this organization is having in a community. So it's wonderful to be here.
So our next guest is Ray Snape, who we're going to be talking to about careers education in primary school. So Ray, why don't you introduce yourself first of all, please?
Hi, everyone. My name is Ray Snape. I'm the head teacher of Milton Road Primary School. I've been a head teacher for 17 years, and I'm really passionate about the idea that if we want our young people to go into a range of different professions, they need to have some of those experiences when they are quite little.
So with the Cambridge Tech Podcast, so to pick up that point, how do you see children getting exposure to tech and opportunities in tech? This kind of came up in the conversation we had with Daniel earlier today. It feels to me, at least, that we lack good role models in tech, especially people that are willing to go into schools and talk to children. In the US, you've got the other extreme where you have these celebrity, almost billionaire, you know, founders of tech businesses like, you know, Elon Musk. What do you think the answer is for the UK?
We're already doing incredible work in schools, but I also think there's an opportunity for tech companies, for example, Arm, AstraZeneca, to identify even more ambassadors that can go into primary schools. It doesn't have to be very complicated. It can be just a 20-minute meet and greet and conversation followed by questions. But the research is very clear that by the age of six, children are already forming ideas about what professions they'd like to go into when they're older. And by nine, some of those ideas have been almost crystallized and they've defined what jobs they won't be doing and what jobs, based on their skills and ability, they feel they're most likely to be successful in.
And based on the fact that these children, well, your children at least, are in Cambridge, in the heart of one of the UK's leading tech sectors, what kind of careers are they kind of saying that they are interested in?
Well, when I asked one of my five-year-olds what careers they wanted to do when they were older, the answer was, I want to be a vet, I want to be an astronaut, I want to be a scientist, and I want to be a unicorn. So children have a really broad idea of the kinds of professions that there are around them. And I think they are probably inspired either by their parents or by some of the experiences that teachers are able to share with the children. So they're learning about possible careers in many different ways. One of the key things that we introduced in our school is called Tiny TED Talks, so not affiliated, but the idea that we would have people mostly within the parent body who could come into the school and they talk about their professions. And we've had a range of really successful talks from neuroscientists, cancer research scientists, somebody who made a critical component part that was part of the Jupiter mission. So that's one of the joys of being in Cambridge, is that you are really surrounded by really talented people. But I have to say, it does slightly work both ways, in that it isn't straightforward. Talking to young children requires a lot of skill, and some adults are probably happy to speak to a whole room of other adults and might feel quite nervous talking to teeny tiny children.
I love that as an idea. You know, it eliminates that you can't be what you can't see. Yes. You know, you're really opening up the ideas earlier on. And that, I think that's really important. And you, as a national leader of education, must see lots of examples of companies doing the right things. Yes. They maybe need to do a little bit more than they are. And you just gave an example then about Abcam and Arm, about being ambassadors into schools. Do you think that they're doing enough? Do you think, not those companies specifically, but do you think STEM companies across Cambridge and broader across the UK are actually doing enough?
I think it's difficult to answer that, because I can't speak from their perspective. They may feel that they're really doing a lot of heavy lifting. And going back to a comment that was said by a speaker earlier, you know, I'm not in the business of throwing stones. I think all of us are doing the best that we can with what we have. But I do think there's an opportunity for yet more creativity and brokering partnerships. And that is what Form the Future do so well. But brokering partnerships, perhaps to work with even younger children, could be a really great project. But it all works when tech companies, STEM companies, industries, charities, we have a whole range of different employers within Cambridgeshire. If they see themselves participating in the education ecosystem, not distinct from the job of educating children, but absolutely working side by side. Because, of course, the children sitting in classrooms today are the citizens that are going to be in the team room, the colleagues working on boards. So we just need to have a longer term strategy of more joined up thinking.
So, Anne, so much goes into organising a day like today. You must be pleased how it's gone. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I'm thrilled. It's been a fantastic conference so far. We've done this for many years. Every year I think is the best. I think this one's even better. The feedback I'm getting from people in between the sessions has been that this is a really good use of their time. Someone said this is the best way I could have spent today. And that's really important to me, because I want to make this worthwhile for everyone. And we have a really diverse audience here. So the fact that it's meeting their needs is fantastic.
Picking up on that, Anne, the atmosphere is actually really lovely. And I don't want that to sound kind of fluffy and soft and everything. It's just people have chosen to come here because they see real purpose and they really want to be involved, and they're coming from all different walks of life. And it is a really positive atmosphere of people that want to create impact. And if I may be so bold, because obviously I've known you for a long time, I think it's like amazing to see all the team, you know, because we see the team in disparate little activities here, there and everywhere, but actually seeing the whole team together and how polished it is, I kind of feel really proud for you as well.
I feel really proud of the team. They work so hard. They work hard every day, but they work really hard to help out at an event like this too. We love bringing the whole team together because they're really special. They're very purpose-driven. I mean, what you said about what you pick up in terms of the vibe and the from the audience, there is a very strong sense of purpose here. We're here for young people. Daniel Zeichner said something really important this morning, and it's something that I often talk about too, which is we are in the business of human potential. And if we can start to make lives better as a result of what we're talking about today, if we're changing some of the thinking, creating new ideas, creating connections. I mean, I know we're creating connections between educators and employers, between some of the placemakers, politicians who are here, who are listening in and learning. I think we're all learning a lot today. Yeah, we'll have achieved something.
Daniel also said, you know, you commented on just about the uniqueness of the organization, right? You know, spotting that gap and being that bridge between young people and employers, you know, that need that's been met, you know, so well by you guys is, you know, real credit to you as well. So moving on then to the actual day itself, what are the key themes that you're seeing from the conference today?
So I already mentioned human potential. You know, that's a really important thing that we don't forget that. I mean, we've talked about things like young people and their attitudes and expectations of the workplace. We've talked again about, are they ready for work? You know, there's lots of complaints are made that young people aren't work ready, but how are they expected to be ready? You know, we have to have intent in the way we go out and engage with them, offer them opportunities, teach them how to do things in the workplace. You know, we've talked a lot about the damage that COVID caused in terms of lost learning, but also the lost opportunity to have a Saturday job or take part in activities that they normally should have been able to do. And that has set some young people back. Now, we have to help them recover from that. And that means giving them opportunities. One of the themes, I think people are really realizing how important work experience is. You know, you just can't expect people to be work ready if you don't give them a chance to experience the workplace. So I would hope if one thing changes from here, that we would leave with many more companies opening their doors to young people for work experience placements.
That's a very good rallying call for you there. Thank you for, you know, having us come here and spend the day with you and joining the sessions. And we've had some great interviews, really enjoyed it. Let's sign off with a call to action from you. You've said about work experience, but how do you want people to get involved? How can they find you?
There are many different ways people can help. You can give your time as an ambassador. You can get involved in Cambridge Launchpad if you're a STEM-based company and give hands-on opportunities to young people. You can join as an enterprise advisor and be linked to a school. You can support us financially. That always helps. There are lots of ways of doing that. We'd be happy to provide more information. And I guess generally, you know, if you have anything to do with children, young people, education, or you want to, just come and talk to us because we can make it happen.
Today's show was produced by Carl Homer of Cambridge TV and supported by our media partner, Business Weekly. The Cambridge Tech Podcast is available on all major podcast platforms and on cambridgetechpodcast.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star review. It will really help others discover the show.
Local community projects consistently face shortfalls of millions of pounds. At Cambridgeshire Community Foundation, we work with businesses and individuals to provide grants to local community-based projects making a difference across Cambridgeshire. To join us in shaping a better county for all, please go to cambscf.org.uk.